Am I having more crazy thoughts?
I'm interested to know why you think the Jupiter expeditions are a distant possibility.
For two reasons. One, Jupiter, I'm speaking both as a scientist and technologist. As a scientist, Jupiter is a fascinating laboratory. The planet, the moon, Io in itself, has very many interesting features in it as a terrestrial object. It is an observing point on Jupiter itself, where it's a major, shall we call it, hydromechanical laboratory, the movement of fluids embedded with magnetic fields. And the radiation belts of Jupiter, which we know are very substantial, are probably a very good laboratory as well. Technologically, it's a long way. It's four times the distance from the Sun, so 1/16th of the energy falls on a satellite there. It's going to be very cold, very little energy, and it's going to strain the technology very, very much, which is what the technological drive usually needs to be. I admit that it's a much more way out, in more ways than one, suggestion than Mars. But given that Mars were the first target, I think something like Io would probably be the second target.
Are there any materials
that
you will require for all this space exploration, communication, and so on, which Australia might well develop?
Hard to know at this time. I think the ceramics, of course, will be more and more an area of importance in space and elsewhere. We could be, we of course have a lot of feedstock, but ceramic feedstocks are fairly ubiquitous too. I would hope that some of the activities that have been going on in Australia in the ceramics area could see that we would be involved. I think one of the interesting stories of Man on the Moon was that a key piece of technology, namely the sunglasses that the astronauts wore, was a technology developed in Adelaide, and the NASA couldn't find the any technology in the US, and of course anyone who's been involved in the American program knows full well that if anyone but anyone in the US can say they'll make it, NASA will not buy it from overseas. What I'm saying is that the technology in the case of the moon landing came from Australia, because Australia was the only place that could do it. I wouldn't be surprised if in that sort of area, but I couldn't predict it. It's a possibility. I think you'd have to say that in a number of areas without... I can't put my finger on anything which is an absolute surety. What is clear, though, is that if we want to be involved, say, in 2015 in space manufacture, we have to be involved now in making things to go into space, and I'm pleased to say that in the last few years that's beginning to happen.
I wonder if you haven't said too much about the cost of getting into the technology area of space. With countries like Russia and America, it's quite clear they've got defense interests, and therefore are prepared to spend a large amount of money.
Imagine that the Australian government might hook up to spending the amounts
thanks Bill. The Australian government currently recognises one reason and one reason only for space R&D, and I think it's the right one. It's industry development. It is to make sure that our industry has the skills and the demonstrated skills to be able to provide our own requirements and to be able to export some appropriate technologies. The reason we do that, of course, is let's face it, space is a fairly small part of any economy. But the reason you do it is to make sure that you have access to some of the new technologies. Because despite my comment that operational space is always very well proven technology, there are new technologies being cast up in parallel with that and in certain research areas. And so countries invest in space to make sure, first of all, that they, well, basically to make sure they stay in space to get the diffusion of new ideas and new concepts at an early time into the rest of their industry. And that's the reason Australia currently has a small program in space, and that small program exists because of recognition that that principle was right. Took place in about 1984. I think that's the only argument that will keep us in it. We currently have a national space program. If you add up everyone, all contributions, of about $20 million, of which only six is in the national space program, but the other 14 are in places such as CSIRO, Bureau of Meteorology and so on. If we want to be really serious in our small way, that needs to be something more like 50 million. And there are steps afoot which could lead us to that. What we, of course, as I've kept implying, on the other hand, there will be new forces in space of a commercial nature. Now, commercial companies don't go in for R&D to any great degree at the level we're talking about. But I could imagine that we will see commercial involvement maybe within 10 years with Australian companies taking equity in ventures. It's a different... And funding of that, of course, comes from a totally separate person. John?
Can I assume that your commercial judgment on the protection of the industry is related to Capricola and not Mars? Serious question. You didn't mention, I was wondering if you would, the prospect by that time of using something in space to protect the greenhouse effects and collecting filters up in space, letting more heat out of the sun, something like that.
I'd have to say, John, I don't believe I'm sufficiently across that as a principle at this moment. It's a nice idea, and I haven't heard enough about the negative impact of it. I have to say I hesitate. Just because we're mucking up the atmosphere with one junk, something says don't put another junk there. We remember what happened to the rabbit. I would like to think that we looked at it in a much more careful way before we ever considered something like that. And I'd certainly personally need to know more about it before I suggested it. We all know that you can't increase funds overnight because all manner of nasty things happen, like government takes it back. It's one of the first things that happens. A run-up over 5 years is manageable and realistic. And then, of course, it has to be in inflation-corrected dollars, but that's the sort of build-up which would be appropriate.
If you don't get to that sort of magic number by absolute security, you then become a union,
No, I won't go as far as that. I think we've already gone, in our little way, we have gone beyond the totally non-involved level. Whether we can keep up the pace, as, for example, we're asked to, we were offered an opportunity to join with the French in building the next generation SPOT, remote sensing satellites. Arguably the best remote sensing satellite the world has. The French have done a marvellous job. We were offered an opportunity, we didn't have the money. Pure and simple. And so we're already partway, but we have to be able to keep going with when those offers are made. And I think what would happen if we stayed at the equivalent of 20 and didn't get up to 50, we might be able to take one offer every 7 years, while for, from the point of view of the industry that we're good at and what we should be doing, it would be better if we were able to be involved not once every 7 years in a small part of a commercial or operational program, but 3 times in 7 years. That would be, I think, an appropriate type of level that I would hope to achieve.
If your forecasts come true, I would imagine there will be a very large number of satellites in space by 2015. Have we adequate international controls in place at this time, or is that something else that has to be addressed?
I'm actually not sure that there will be. I think, you see, we'll see less communication satellites. So much more use of cable. The remote sensing satellites are expensive, and already the Americans and the French are talking of joining forces, because neither thinks they can afford it in the future, and I can well imagine a number of marriages of convenience such as this. There will of course be a lot of what we might call beginner kit satellites being flown by other countries that are getting into the business, recent countries into the business being Israel, for example. But those satellites usually live only for, they come back into the atmosphere quite quickly. So I think actually the number of satellites, active satellites, could well plateau out and then begin to drop in the 1990s. There are, of course, some fairly fundamental political and international issues. One that I'm certainly aware of, and I'm sure there are some I'm not, but there is a policy, or it's the Open Skies Policy, it's called, which is to do with looking down on countries from in space. And that allows, it is said to allow a country to look at any other country, and it doesn't have to tell the country it's doing it. But if it sells the product, it has to be prepared to sell it to the country that was imaged. Of course, if it doesn't sell the product, well, now what's going to happen in the near future is that technology currently really prevents a satellite to look down on a country like Australia without us knowing too much about it, because the signals have to be transmitted. They can't be stored very well on board, and they have to be transmitted to Earth and recorded on the ground. And technology has reached the point where that won't be necessary. a satellite would be able to go round and round the world and send the signals, the pictures of Australia, or wherever else, back to the providing, originating country, using relay satellites up at the geostationary orbit. I think that's going to produce a lot of very difficult and acrimonious discussions, because we'll start to have crop predictions, we'll have various things going on or believed to be going on, and I would imagine that the 1990s will see a lot of disputation in that general area.
You've been talking about the growth industry. From the human element, do you believe that Australia is now adequately, excuse me, an institutional institution to provide the personnel that are going to be required at a whole range of levels to service that industry?
What's been going in tertiary area over the last few years doesn't give me much confidence, but we will have the type of innovative people that we have. I think we'll have a lot of very good commercially and active people, but I certainly feel apprehensive that we'll have the people who can continue to develop uses of remote sensing, the competent engineers that we've had that have done very good things in communications. I'm not at all convinced. I remain to be convinced that what we're putting into place in our university system now will continue to give us the good product we've had in the past. As a product of this, what was the second smallest university in Australia, University of Tasmania at the time, to be able to walk into MIT and be offered a teaching position, the only one that was offered in the laboratory the following year. I know what I'm saying, that Australian education has been second to none. I mean, I guess I worry that that is going to continue, but there are people who are more knowledgeable than I, and I'd like to hear them tell me how well they protect the situation that we have. But I worry.
I think I must go.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Doctor. I think we have a dinner engagement in a few minutes, and I would like to call on one of our members to move a vote of thanks to Dr. McCracken. And I'm referring to Sir Robert Price, who was chairman of CSIRO, has been governor of this foundation for a number of years and recently retired, and in fact was a foundation member of the Sciences Club. So I think we have a very fitting gentleman here to move a vote of thanks to our speaker for this evening. Thank you, Sir Robert.
You better have that.
Chairman, Dr. McCracken and friends. I first met Dr. McCracken back in the 1970s, I think, when I visited his laboratory or his office in the Department of Physics at the University of Adelaide. He was a professor in the physics department at that time. And I visited him not just for social a chap, but in order to try and persuade him to join CSIRO. And rather to my surprise, I was successful. Ken did join CSIRO, and he's been with it ever since, and of course is one of the organisation's most erudite staff members. He has operated for the last several years, virtually on your own, I think. Is that right, Ken?
I've had 15 very good assistants.
Yes, but it was, by comparison with most CSIRO divisions, a very, very small group. entitled COSSA.
Yes.
I'm not too sure what the letters stand for.
CSIRO, Office of Space Science and Applications.
So CSIRO has been very fortunate over the years in getting Ken McFadden at the time when we might have lost him to the United States. And I think what he's told of this evening makes quite clear what an effective scientist, practicing scientist, he has been for the organisation and more importantly for Australian science as a whole. I found it very gratifying that he felt in a position to compare Australian graduates very favourably with those from many other countries. And certainly he is a very good example of that thesis. Thank you very much indeed, Ken, for a fascinating talk. I hope we might see more of you now that you've retired. It is interesting to me that two senior fellows from CSIRO who've retired, namely Ken himself and David Solomon, are both turning into farmers. Now, I don't know whether there's any sort of logic about this, but and perhaps Ken could elucidate.
I thought I recalled a chairman who did something similar
to that. Not I, sir. Anyway, I'm sure you all want me to thank Ken very much indeed for a most fascinating talk, a very pleasant evening, and we hope we'll have an opportunity of chatting later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much.